Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Peter Phillips. It's great having Peter back. Peter is a Sonoma State University sociology professor, and he's formerly the director of Project Censor. He held that post for many years. He's now president of the Media Freedom Foundation. It's an initiative for First Amendment freedoms and investigative research. It works closely with Mickey Huff, who comes on this program often, who now heads Project Censored, and they both work together for the same things that are so vital, the major protections that are eroding so fast on the way to disappearing if ordinary people don't take it upon themselves to stop the human rights atrocities that not only go on abroad, they go on against people right here in this country. Project Censored and Media Freedom Foundation are bulwarks against these abuses, and Mickey and Peter are heroes because of what they do. Peter, I welcome you on the program. So much going on.
Well, Steve, thanks very much. It's a wonderful introduction.
Oh, you deserve it. You deserve it. I mean, you've been on the front lines for so long. I was a newcomer to the battle lines. My God, I didn't start this stuff until I was age 70. I was always concerned, but, lots of us had another life to live. I did. And at age 70, I began my wondrous second career. Oh, I must say, you know, the first one earned me a living. This one is all volunteer, but I must say, of the two, this one definitely is the more important.
Well, we kind of do that simultaneously, of course. Most of the people inside of Project Censored are college professors at the core, and we're at, you know, a dozen universities across the country and then overseas as well. So we all have day jobs teaching, and then we really put a lot of energy into looking at important news stories that aren't covered by the media, writing this annual book, maintaining a website of constant feeds. So we really stay at it.
Oh, I do know that. I didn't mean to underplay or underestimate that at all. My God.
No, I know that.
You've got a full-time teaching job. My goodness. And Project Censored is attached to that. It's simply another initiative that you're involved with, that you have been, and now the Media Freedom Foundation, same for Mickey. And but I only had one life that I lived.
Well, at least with us, we can overlap. Our classes, of course, will research news stories, and then we have students that get credit for helping do investigative research as well as even writing parts of the book every year. So Mickey's right now coordinating, a half a dozen students with follow-up on the stories from last year, which was usually our Chapter 2 in our Censored Yearbook. And then, of course, the news stories that are frivolous, the junk food news stories and stories that are overdone by the corporate media, there's a chapter on that. So that's always one the students are heavily involved in.
Oh, the students. It's wonderful to get the young people involved in this sort of thing, Peter, and make them, give them an awareness that there never were things like this going on when I was their age, going to college in the 1950s. Project Censored didn't come around until the mid-70s, and there was none of this. And I don't remember having much in the way of professors at school that really were on the right side of the issues the way you and Mickey and a fair number of others who come on this program are absolutely on the right side, and this has to reflect in their classrooms. And I had a couple. The most glorious professor I had was in a required natural science course, so we concentrated on that topic, not his activism, and I didn't realize how active he was. George Wald was his name. He became a Nobel laureate in his field years later. But he was marvelous. I loved him. I loved his classes, even though science wasn't my field. And I only took the course because I had to. But I was so lucky to have someone like him. And if he were living today, Peter, I absolutely would have him on this program. Sadly, that was long ago. And another man who lived to age 97, I'm not sure how much on the right side of things he was, a wonderful political science professor by the name of Sam Beer. And I discovered, I think it's over a year ago now, that he lived to age 97, and he was lucid right up to the end. And I do know that he lived in Nazi Germany for a while. I had him for a freshman political science course, social science course they called it, and he was a powerful lecturer, and he stuck to the course content, so I don't know what his ideology was, but I later learned that he lived in Nazi Germany for a while in the 30s, and he absolutely despised Nazism, fascism, so I just have to believe that that he must have detested the stuff he saw going on in this country as the fascist influence grows and the wars proliferate. And had I known he was still living and lucid and maybe willing, maybe through my university I could have found out how to reach him and get him on my program. Oh, that would have been a thrill.
Yeah.
I do remember how impressive he was in class, and he literally had the most popular course on campus. Everybody wanted to take a course with him anyway. We have today's issues to deal with. We've got them here at home, Peter. We've got them overseas. I've focused so heavily on what I fear is coming, another war against Syria, and dare I say the possibility of wanting that, and it obsesses me, and I've been writing volumes on it. Any thoughts on that yourself?
Well, certainly what we're seeing out of Syria is the Hula massacres that happened 2 weeks ago were, you know, labeled as an attack by Syrian forces on a defenseless village. We now know that most of the people in that village were killed at close range with knives and guns, and it's a terrible thing, but we don't know who the perpetrators were. And the Syrian government is saying, absolutely, we didn't do it. I mean, if they had artillery and they were standing off somewhere, why would they go in and bayonet and kill people face-to-face who hadn't been resisting? There wasn't any resistance in that village. They were just massacred. So there's certainly indications that this could be very much like Rorschach was during the war against Serbia, a trigger incident that was not necessarily perpetrated by those that the corporate media in the West is saying did it. And that becomes a serious problem, because if that escalates, the general impression, the cartoons in the papers in the United States, and there's a cartoon in our paper today of Syria, this big war machine, you know, and pulling a little pulley cart with a UN observer in it, saying, now, you stop that. So it's implied that there's this juggernaut of power and just roaring through the countryside, and the UN isn't doing anything. So there's an implication that we need to do something.
Well, I must say, Peter, Global Research, a day or two ago, published an article translated from Russian into English. And I wrote an article that was posted on Global Research today. A Russian journalist by the name of Marat Musin, he was there in Hula. He saw firsthand what went on, and he interviewed survivors. And based on his account, firsthand, there is no question that the Syrian government had absolutely nothing to do with the slaughter. They were civilians who were killed in cold blood. They were pro-Assad loyalists. They were targeted because they supported the Assad government. And they were literally, their homes were invaded, and they were either shot at close range, or they were stabbed to death. And he made it very clear from what he wrote, and I took snippets in my article. I had a long introduction explaining that when you want to go to war, it depends on first selling it to the home front. You have to have public support. And it doesn't matter whether you've got a dictatorship or a democracy. Mm-hmm. And I went through that in some detail, and going back and citing other sources. And then I got to his article. and I pull snippets, quotes from the Global Research translation. Somebody translated it and Global Research posted it. And, I mean, it was marvelous to have somebody there and telling the truth. And I didn't for a minute believe that the Syrian government would do something like this. What on earth would they stand to gain by killing innocent civilians? They would know that the wrath of God would come down on them for doing it. And but unfortunately, as to be expected, the major media, the people I call media scoundrels, Peter, you know, in lockstep, they point fingers only at Assad, and it's almost like an afterthought that maybe some insurgents were involved as well. The UN Human Rights Council, I quoted Anabe Pillay. I mean, she's supposed to respect human rights. She made scathing comments. There's an investigation on Syria. They've done others, but this is the latest one that began, I think yesterday, either Friday or Saturday, and they'll wind it up maybe today, and they'll publish their accounts. Based on her comments, I mean, she basically pointed fingers the wrong way at Assad. And from the evidence that I've seen, this is absolutely false. But it just continues over and over and over again. The so-called Middle East envoy, Kofi Annan, well, during 10 years as Secretary General of UN, he never lifted a finger to stop the imperial wars. His peace plan, I describe as masquerade cover to let the crimes go on, and he points fingers at Assad. And Ban Ki-moon, same thing. I fear greatly that a war is coming. I fear it greatly. I see the Libya situation repeating, so far short of NATO bombing, but the insurgents on the ground are doing the same things in Syria that they did in Libya, and so far Russia and China are bulwarks. They will not allow Security Council resolution to pass that even smells slightly of war. But Susan Rice, this lunatic fringe UN envoy, and Hillary Clinton a little bit too, basically said, well, you know, if the Security Council won't authorize it, we can go around the Security Council. And that's what happened in Kosovo, Serbia in 1999, and it looks like it's going to happen again against Syria.
Yeah. I'm looking at Michelle Choskodowski's piece from Friday, Syria, NATO's Next Humanitarian War. And for anybody that wants to see the history on this and really take a look at the reality, you know, he's citing reports where agents from MI6 and the CIA were already in Syria well before the unrest began. Special forces were talking to and training Syrian dissident soldiers. The Free Syrian Army is now, we know, fully armed by other states. This was ongoing. And then something I had noticed early on is that it's pretty much the Libya model, in that you discredit a dictator, say that they're in, you know, suppressing their people, create a military force that has an uprising and is externally supported. The dictator responds. You call him, you know, a humanitarian, brutal, you know, killing machine, and then you go in for purposes of saving the people. The coordinator for that in Libya was U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford, who had come straight from Baghdad, where he was part of what was, you know, the insurgencies there. He's becomes the ambassador in Libya as the unrest takes forward. Then he's transferred over to Syria. And so as he's working there, the unrest unfolds. So this Robert S. Ford seems to be an American lead person for helping coordinate regime change around the world.
Oh, he's popped up before. I absolutely agree, Peter. And as soon as they dispense with Syria, if it happens, they'll move on to Iran. And here's a president who promised as a candidate that he was going to get America out of the wars. I've quoted some of his comments verbatim on the campaign trail. in October 2007, he was very pointed about saying that if the Iraq and Afghan wars weren't over by the time he took office, if he was elected, he would get America out of these wars. And his punchline was, and you can take that to the bank.
Well, you could have, yeah, he took it to the bank. America gets out, NATO goes in. Of course, it's the same troops. NATO becomes the international arm of the transnational corporate class of the Western capitalist powers, particularly the central banks. And now, of course, is occupying Libya and taking a broader role across the world. Inevitably, the NATO conference, of course, in Chicago 2 weeks ago laid that out, that NATO was going to become the police force, literally, for the UN.
Well, that's exactly so. And whenever I think of NATO, Peter, I think of it as a code word for Washington. If Washington was not belligerent, I don't think NATO would be the same thing. Oh, you've got belligerents like Britain and France, especially. Other times, Germany, Italy. But NATO has 28 countries, and they have many partner countries. I was astonished to learn that with the NATO states, 28, and all the partner countries, they comprise one-third of the world's nations. Well, Luxembourg, this tiny Luxembourg, I'm sure Greater Chicago covers more territory and has a lot more people than Luxembourg, tiny country. You could probably drive through it fast and not realize you even passed through the country with open borders. Luxembourg is a NATO member, a NATO member state. What on earth would Luxembourg want to get involved in fighting a NATO war anywhere? But NATO operates under the Three Musketeers Doctrine, as I like to call it. One for all and all for one. Get into a war. If America goes to war and calls on its NATO partners, well, the NATO charter says they all have to pitch in to help in some way or other. But again, you've got these tiny countries grouped with the larger ones, and it just seems like an insane thing.
Well, inevitably for Poland and for some of the Eastern Bloc countries that are now part of NATO, sending troops overseas is profit-taking. You're paid to do it. Plus, your troops get experience in the field. So it's a win-win situation as far as those governments are concerned. So they make money, and then they have these experienced troops that will be back and available in case there's civil unrest inside their own countries.
You know, I don't know very much about that. Has Project Censored covered that issue and had an article discussing it in detail?
You know, not specifically that I know of. I do know that the majority of the money going to NATO is from the U.S.
Yeah.
That we dominate the entire thing, but that... to get these countries to participate. So Poland sends in a regiment of Marines or Army into Afghanistan. And it's a NATO occupation process. And then they are, in turn, they're reimbursed for that. So it becomes part of the propaganda, the coalition of the willing. You know, all these countries are going to participate, and that it has a psychological advantage, a propaganda advantage, saying, "Oh, we all agree." But no, they're often pressured. If they want weapon systems, they have to coordinate and be part of NATO. They have to standardize their weapons. Those weapons are mostly provided by the U.S. and British companies, some French. It's a whole profit-making system, but it also benefits the origin countries. So those countries in the Eastern Bloc that have troops in Afghanistan are, in fact, making money off of that.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. I do know they coordinate their weapons in America and Britain, whatever, sell the weapons, and it's a giant profit-making scheme. And if you have weapons, you've got munitions, and the people, the companies that make them want to sell more. So the way you sell more is you go to war and you use up this stuff, and then you have to replace it. And, of course, you've got new generation of weapons coming along. It's a pretty sick system. I wonder what Eisenhower would say if we could resurrect him.
What he would have said.
Yeah.
Because he said it. I mean, you know, there's to watch out for this military-industrial complex. And now, I mean, you really say it's an international, the U.S. NATO military-industrial media complex.
Oh, indeed.
Charging forward to protect the transnational corporate class of the world.
Exactly.
Protect capitalism.
Oh,
protect money flow.
Protect capitalism. Keep predatory capitalism safe, and leave it free to exploit ordinary people and benefit at their expense. It's a pretty sick, destructive game that keeps going on, Peter. I was so energized last September when the Occupy Wall Street movement started, and I wrote an article called OWS Act 2 that came out in May, and I don't know just whether it is going in any degree strong right now. I'm not seeing very much about it, but I'm very concerned about the energy waning, and that was the most exciting thing I saw happening since the civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 1960s. And it's the one thing that if it can really get into high gear and attract a lot more adherence, this is the way you can bring about change. If you get enough people upset enough and dedicated enough to sustain a struggle for real change, not baloney that comes from the politicians, but real change, they'll never do it, then that's the way change can come. It's happened in this country before. It can happen again, but it never happens easily or quickly, and people literally have to put their bodies on the line for us.
Yeah.
And they're being targeted, not just locally, but FBI, Homeland Security. There is a jihad out to destroy this movement. So they're really going up against the power system, and how they'll fare in the months ahead, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, you know, I really had to think through how the election and then, of course, the unlimited spending by corporations now as legal people, you really have an election coming up that's illegitimate. That you have Obama and Romney running for the presidency with over $1 billion being spent by each party to advertise and pretend there's really a contest of and a difference. We no longer have legitimate democratic elections in the country. And so I wrote a piece called Desperate Times Requires Revolutionary Measures, and that runaway capitalism is moving unrelentingly towards socio-political environmental collapse, and that there's a two-headed single-party machine known as the U.S. Congress that applauds this. And, you know, and we have to realize that it no longer voting for a Democrat or even a progressive Democrat. We have, you know, Norman Solomon running for the Congress here in our district, and a lot of the progressive Democrats are saying, yeah, let's get him into Congress. Once there's little flexibility. You're subject to party discipline if you're a Democrat. You may be able to occasionally vote a symbolic resistance vote. But there's not any opportunity whatsoever to change this juggernaut of transnational global power and the military machine. There's just Congress is not capable of doing that. And so it becomes a situation where Chris Hedges says, don't waste any more time or energy on the presidential election than it takes to go to your polling station and pull a lever for a third-party candidate. Just enough to register your obstruction and defiance. Then get back into the street. That's where the question of real power is being decided. Chris Hedges said that last month.
Well, I certainly agree with that. It comes from the grassroots always, and the people at the top never will do it. I think our political system is you're saying, Peter. It's totally dysfunctional. It's corrupt. You can get a good, few good people in Congress. Cynthia McKinney certainly was true blue, and they simply can't do a thing. And
they ran her out.
They ran her out twice. Twice they ran her out. And my God,
she's going to run as a Green, and again, she just announced that, which is kind of interesting. But in Congress, wealth begets membership. In other words, the House and the Senate have a collective net worth of $2.04 billion. Now, that's up almost 20% from 2008, where it was 1.6. So, you know, the Congress gets richer. At the same time, American households are worth less and continue to decline, and more people are living in poverty. So Congress is an artificial organization that serves as a cheerleaders to this transnational corporate class. And if anything, it's members in Congress that have a transitional path to the good life of corporate affluence, as long as they remain loyal to party discipline. So that's really how where we are today. I mean, it's reform's not an option. We really need to look at possible action and returning to the social justice values of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights and our religions that manifest themselves in street action and day-to-day behaviors that are resistant to this, to corporate power.
Well, absolutely true, Peter. And I hope we'll really see it crank up at some point, because it's the only chance we have. It's astonishing. I mean, you get these people in Congress, as you say, they come into Congress and they get rich being there. And if they decide they want to leave after so many years, Chris Dodd left, decided not to run for re-election, and he left and took a lush job. Don't know his title, but it's got something to do with, I think, the Motion Picture Association, and he's either got a top executive position. I think it's a top executive position in it, or maybe a top lobbyist position representing them. And whatever he made in Congress, he's probably making 10 times as much now. So he's lobbying for cybersecurity and things like that. In other words, destroying the free and open Internet. Mm-hmm. But in Congress, he certainly didn't do anything to help ordinary people. So-called financial reform was written by the bankers. It may have put a few things in there that they would just as soon not have had. But it was just cover to throw a few crumbs at the people and let them think they're really getting something, while the real meat that should have been in there never got in, because the bankers wrote the law. And healthcare reform, the same thing. I do know that WellPoint Health had the most influence in writing so-called healthcare reform. And you knew that things were going to be okay when the banking stocks went up after Chris Dodd, after Chris Dodd bill. And the healthcare stocks went up after Obama's health package passed. And I mean, that was the tip off that there was nothing in either of these bills that would harm these people. They could just go on and keep doing business as usual. And that's the way that Congress operates. People are left out in the cold. They're punished. They're hurt badly. And as bad as, well, I mean, it never was good, Peter. My recollections go back a lot of years, 1950s, 1960s. Well, it was a lot different then in a lot of respects. That we got, my goodness, we got Medicare in the mid-1960s, and now it's being systematically destroyed. And who's destroying it? Not a Republican, a Democrat. Unimaginable, but it's happening.
Yeah, we see that just dismantling of the social programs that emerged in the 60s and the complete reversal of that, moving towards every person for themselves, gung ho. If you can't get on board, then too bad, you fall by the wayside and you die from disease, or you're in poverty. So the idea of a collective support for human beings that the government addresses has been seriously challenged. And anything that smacks of that is labeled a socialist or even communist. And unfortunately, a whole lot of people have accepted that propaganda as the way that the world has to survive, and it's survival of the fittest, and the rest of us be damned.
the rest of us be damned. And that's exactly the way it happens. And you can see it in the legislation coming out of Congress, the things that Obama supports. The rhetoric is one thing and the policies are something else.
Yeah.
And there have been terrible abuses committed on people. Just the economic well-being of people in the country, Peter. And I doubt that few American households have a clue at what's coming year end if something doesn't happen in the Congress to stop it. But here, post-election, if whenever they want to bring the hammer down, they wait mainly until post-election. So as soon as the dust settles on that, the game plan, Republicans and Democrats, to enact a minimal $4 trillion cut affecting domestic programs, Medicare, Medicaid. What people need most are the things that will get hammered, and it will go on and on, and I doubt you'll find 1 in 100 people who have a clue about this. Oh, we're at the bottom of the hour. Let's take a quick break, Peter, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
Welcome back on with Peter Phillips, Project Censored, Media Freedom Foundation, Sonoma State University. Peter, welcome back. My goodness, so gruesome, so troublesome, and yet at the same time, there's one great advantage that we have today that certainly didn't exist when I was growing up. There were no computers back then, there was no internet, there was no alternative media. There was also no Fox News and some of that. That was only three TV channels at one time. And the evening news consisted, that I remember, my earliest memory was about 15 minutes a night, and that was it. But we had Walter Cronkite then. I don't remember when he started, but certainly a little bit later, Walter Cronkite, and today we have the likes of the types that show up, and we really sunk so low. But we have a public space online, and we can use it, and we're able to reach a lot of people, and so many millions are connected. We've got to get them to forget about the major media and go to the alternative media. And reports keep coming out, Peter. I'm sure you've seen some of this stuff, that the network news operations and some of their other programs, talk shows or whatever, their ratings are beginning to drop quite a bit.
Well, we keep encouraging that, as do you, and our efforts are to help people identify sources on the internet that are trustworthy news sources. So that's basically what Project Censored does, is that we have professors evaluate news stories, and then we're posting them online so that people can get a glimpse of news they're not seeing in the corporate media. We do that in English and in Spanish. And then we have these daily news feeds. So as I was talking about global research articles from Michelle Cheskodowska, I was pulling that right off our daily independent news feed. So this is the latest updates from 30 independent news sites from around the world, where you can see more news there in one page and click on each story than's in the New York Times. So all of that is fed off of the projectcensored.org site. And you can just click right on daily news and see what's been happening around the world from different perspectives of other people.
Oh, that's absolutely marvelous. Maybe you can take a peek at my blog site someday and pluck off some of the stuff that's on
there
to your liking. And, that would be marvelous. Global Research posts a number of my articles. I think I write too many for them to keep up with me, Peter.
Oh, I see your articles there almost all the time, and you write more than I do.
Oh, quite
of course,
a few, and quite a few of them show up there. But I usually do what I call my daily double. And I don't think any editors can quite keep up with that. Some of them try. Some of them post most everything I write, but I think it's impossible for anybody to keep up with every single thing. I don't know how I manage this stuff myself, and I don't usually have a day like today. Today is a super active day. I hosted an inaugural other program in the morning. I have an interview right after this program ends. I have another interview after that one ends. That one's a short one on Russia Today. The one right after this program, I think, is going to run about an hour. The program this morning ran an hour. This runs an hour. And somehow I managed to keep up with my writing, and I stay calm, Peter. That's the most amazing thing.
Well, you know, we would love to have you posting on the Daily Censored, which is our blog. And anytime you want to put up an article, we'll put it up there for you, especially if you just have written it. We try not to duplicate what other people are doing. And the big ones like Truth Out, they will. But we're still growing. We're getting 400,000 unique views a month now on our websites. But the Daily Journal is, we've got about 50 writers. So anytime you've got a piece you think you'd like to put up with us, we'll be happy to do that.
Oh, I would be delighted to do that. I don't dare send you everything, Peter. I will drown you. I will drown out other people. But I could pick sometimes.
We'd be happy to take as many, ones that you would like to put out.
I feel like a parent. Sometimes it's very hard for me, you know, a parent choosing which child do I particularly favor most. Sometimes it's tough for me to choose. If I write that, I don't want to put out anything unless I'm pleased with it, unless I think it's something important that people should know about. But it is true that I think some things are more important than others. I would be absolutely delighted to make a contribution. Maybe you can give me an instruction, shoot me an email, and tell me exactly how to do this, a particular email address to send the, is that the way I would do it, send it to an email address?
Well, we can, if you're an approved writer, you can post directly to the site, the Daily Censored site.
Can you
to our webmaster.
Can you make me an approved writer?
Absolutely.
Oh, if you can.
You are an approved writer. And so the Daily Censored, which is www.dailycensored.com, that's where we have, I post there a lot, Mickey does, we all do, but there's at least 50 other regular writers there, and a whole lot. Danny Weil writes on our education issues, and there's just a lot of different folks that are very much involved, and we'd love to have you post there.
Oh, I would really be on it. Peter, I would be absolutely on it to be on the Daily Censored, and oh my goodness, I'm on the Project Censored site.
If you're on the Project Censored site, look on the right-hand side, and you'll see the Daily Censored button. And you click on that.
Oh, dear, I don't spot it. I don't see it. Up on top?
No, on the right-hand side column.
Well, I see Top Censored Stories, and there's nothing after that on my site.
Underneath, let me look. Okay, I'm back. What happened? It must have bounced out. Daily Censored.
I put in dailycensored.org and I came up to the Project Censored site.
But dailycensored.com. There's a button there. It just moved. I clicked on it. There's a blank space. That's where
DailyCensored.com. Daily Censored News Blog. There it is. The Daily Censored Underreported and News and Commentary. Is that the one?
That's it.
And then to
and
post.
There's a cartoon on it right now. Communism tried to destroy capitalism. And, yeah, that's it.
And to post, I would do what?
To post, you would have a log code down at the bottom. And you would just log in, and we'd give you a code, and then you can post your articles.
Could you send me a code to be able to do that?
Yes, we do.
Oh, that would be marvelous.
Else out there listening that does want to do daily or publish articles, we would be happy to do that. They can send those to me, peter@projectcensored.org, and I'll take a look. And if you're a writer that's really addressing the kinds of issues we want to have up there, we'll put you up.
I think I'm doing just that, Peter, and I think I've done some things that could be a contribution to the site, and I would not want to overload it, but I would send you a good many of the articles that I write.
I think that would be great. That'd be great.
Well, again, it would be a great honor for me to be able to do it. I never had any idea that I was able to do this. I know about the site. I go there every now and then, and I simply didn't imagine that I would be welcome to want to be able to make a contribution to it. I didn't know that was the way the system worked. So you made my day, Peter. You absolutely made the day. I see on the bottom, on the right hand side, it says log in.
Right,
and with a code number, I'd be able to log in.
We'll get you fixed up.
Oh, that's terrific! That is absolutely terrific. Well, I will take advantage of it, and I hope I can make a contribution that others will appreciate reading. And again, it's a wonderful thrill for me to be able to do it.
Good.
Again,
you know, there's a story that I posted. It was a guest writer that wrote it, Dirk Bettel. He lives in Mendocino County. He called me up and he goes, "I have it's an old bank, and they had a museum there. It was called the Mendocino Marijuana Museum, and it was a nonprofit, and they had pictures of the history of marijuana, and but they didn't have any pot there." There wasn't it. They weren't selling it. They weren't medicinal. They were just, it was a museum about marijuana. And their bank called them up and said, "We have to close your account. The DEA has declared that any bank accounts with the name marijuana in them have to be closed." And so they went to another bank, and it was the same thing. They couldn't have, there wasn't a bank that would allow them to open an account with the name marijuana in it. So now they're called the Mendocino Censored Museum, and they describe the whole story. But there's an article on our, if you go down, it says DEA uses local banks to close down Mendocino Marijuana Museum. I mean, talk about reaching into, in an absurd way, you know, local daily business practices.
That really is astonishing, Peter. And on the other hand, with everything going on and the way innocent people are routinely targeted in the country, it sadly is no surprise that...
No, it just keeps happening. I mean,
yeah, it
we're
keeps
building
coming.
A police state that
well, we
can
are
use
becoming.
All kinds of extrajudicial ways of controlling us.
We definitely are becoming a police state, and one of my many focus issues is to write about political prisoners in this country. And I've written literally about dozens of ones that I know about. Most of them are Muslims. Most of them were falsely charged and prosecuted and convicted. And you've got extraordinary people like Lynn Stewart for defending the wrong type clients, one in particular, and they went after her. And
yeah.
There's a lawyer by the name of Paul Berggren. He wanted to get on the witness stand for charges against U.S. soldiers charged with crimes in Iraq, and he wanted to put on the stand the commanders and right up the chain of the command. He wanted to go to the Pentagon. He wanted Rumsfeld. I think he wanted George Bush at the time, and because he wasn't prosecuting these people, but he wanted to hold them account and get them on the witness stand, and he was and he still is an extremely talented defense and prosecuting attorney. He's played both sides of the fence, and they went after him because of that, and they charged him with all kinds of spurious offenses. He'll have multiple trials. He went through the first trial, I think, on murder charges, and the charges were thrown out. We'll move on to the next trial, and whether they convict him or not, they will keep him tied up in prison and in court for years to come, and he may never get out, but because he wanted to go after the real criminals in the country, they went after him like Lynn Stewart, and they put them away. And Paul is in a New York City jail, spending a lot of time in solitary confinement. Lynn is spending 10 years down in Texas. Again, for standing up for what's right against wrong, these people are targeted.
It is,
and I think about this myself.
Scary. it puts a chill on all of us who are engaged in addressing these issues. And, I mean, there's millions of us that do these sorts of things. So, and then there's, you know, tens of thousands of writers and people on local community peace centers and things like that are consistently being infiltrated. So, you know, we're all being watched, so to speak. I assume that you and I both, of course, are watched, and there's records and all of that. But, you know, they can't lock up the whole country, or, you know, at least... We won't have a country if they do. But this, you know, our number one story emerging this year is the police state. That's going to be the top censored story in our book in 2013. And so you have these new bills that Obama has signed, you know, that that H.R. 347, which allows any facility that's controlled by the Secret Service, or any site protected by the Secret Service, it's a felony to plan any kind of a disruption or penetration of or disruption of that site. So that's a whole new approach. So that's preemptive. So if you're organizing a protest against the president at some point, you can be preemptively charged with violation of that law. So it's quite concerning. I mean, right now there's a whole organizing group up here in Northern California that are going to be protesting, which has been happening for 30 some years, the Bohemian Grove encampment, which will be starting July 14th, and that just happens to be Bastille Day. So there's all the Occupy groups. There's a Bohemian Grove network that's been around for three decades, the Code Pink Action, a whole lot of different organizations in Northern California and around are mobilizing to have an assembly that day outside the Grove. Because the president's former President Bush and others are there with Secret Service protection, that law is could be implemented. So, you know, it's concerning. You say, well, we're not doing anything illegal. Well, we're not. We're simply going to have First Amendment rights. We're not even advocating civil disobedience. It's a chilling effect to think that you could be targeted based on new laws for doing something you've been doing for 30 years.
Peter, I've written about much of this myself, including Obama on the very last day of 2011, New Year's Eve, signing the National Defense Authorization Act, that they often slip in a couple of provisions that are just awful. The bill itself is awful. All the hundreds of billions of dollars that go to militarism and imperial wars and the rest of it. But this was the one literally tyranny enacting provisions where any U.S. citizen anywhere in the world could be arrested by the U.S. military, put away uncharged, untried, and held indefinitely, literally for life if they want to keep you there. And Obama signed the law. He claimed that he would veto the bill if it had that provision in it, but Senator Carl Levin spilled the beans. And the original Senate bill did not have U.S. citizens included. And Obama laid the law down and said that he insisted that U.S. citizens be included in the bill. And then after the bill became law, he disingenuously came out with an executive order. As I remember the language, it was a little bit on the weasel side, excluding U.S. citizens. If he didn't want U.S. citizens, he never would have had it in the bill in the first place, but they are in there, and I don't believe for a minute that he wants U.S. citizens excluded. And I just wrote about his kill list that the New York Times had a long article about. I called it Murder Incorporated, official Obama policy. And he can make up a list of anybody anywhere in the world he wants assassinated, and bingo, based on presidential diktat, the person can be killed on the ground. A bomb, a missile, a bullet, a cutthroat. I mean, get rid of this guy. So they could call us terrorists, Peter, and they could come after us.
Special forces are operating in 100 nations in the world. They can identify opposition leaders and assassinate them. It's done daily. And most of the time we don't know about it. but increasingly as these laws are passed, we get a glimpse of the degree of empire control and repression of civil rights that is manifested in the world today.
So true, so true. At the end of, I think it was December of 2008. It was a year-end review article that I wrote, and I think it was in 2008. I wrote an article I called "Police State America," and all I did in the article—it was a very long article. I went through all of the ones I knew about, all of the laws that passed post 9/11, the executive orders, official memoranda, presidential memoranda that I found that I thought were important, so-called national security and presidential. What was the other one? National Security Presidential Directives, and another one that is a dovetail to that. Official policies that come down reflecting police state conditions, and anybody reading that article through December 2008 would have to come to the conclusion that America is a police state. These are police state laws. And the Patriot Act alone, which I included in my article, for the first time, the crime of domestic terrorism was enacted. Who were domestic terrorists? Environmental activists, animal rights activists, people like you and me, Peter.
And Obama's done nothing to change that.
Absolutely nothing.
Absolutely. They've passed laws that have made them even more draconian.
Exactly right. Obama has taken the worst of George Bush and done what I like to say his ardent supporters thought was impossible. He exceeded
Amplified.
The worst of George Bush. He literally exceeded the worst of George Bush, whether it comes to war on peace, whether it comes to going after whistleblowers, police state laws, on and on and on and on. And in a couple of articles, I used a line to the effect that, and just imagine what's coming in a second Obama term if he's reelected.
Exactly. I get arguments from, you know, diehard Democrats saying, oh, well, we have to vote for Obama because that'll make a difference on the Supreme Court. No, it's not. And the Supreme Court isn't going to reverse this police state drama. And it's only going to happen if we can do it collectively as a people.
Well, that's what it comes down to. That really is the bottom line, Peter, and you and I absolutely agree on that. It's never been any other way throughout history. There have been major accomplishments. I talk about them. I reviewed a book some years ago that wrote about them. Francis Fox Pippen wrote a marvelous book called, oh, I can never remember the title. It's been a long time since I did the review, but it was just a marvelous book, and it was about major reforms in America. He included the American Revolution, and I consider that in a different category altogether. U.S. elites versus British elites, and really, when all was said and done, we simply everything changed but stayed the same under new management. I think that's what that came down to. But we did the impossible, ending slavery. We had labor rights. We had civil rights. I mean, we had extraordinary things that people literally put their bodies on the line, fought for many years, and they gained them. And Pippen made the point in her book that unfortunately, and she was so right, unfortunately, after you win some of these games, the energy wanes, and you end up losing everything you fought for. And that's true on labor rights. It's true on civil rights. And instead of chattel slavery, we have wage slavery.
Her book, Regulating the Poor, traces the history of repression of the lower classes quite well.
Oh, is that a title?
Yeah, Regulating the Poor.
Now that might have been a follow-up book. The title that I reviewed was a little different than that. I've got the book.
Yeah, I've studied her. She's an amazing theorist.
She is amazing. She's getting well up in years now, I guess.
Yes.
But once I had her on my program, it was a long time ago, and I tried to get her back one time, and for some reason we couldn't connect with each other. But I've read a number of her books, and that one particularly that book struck me, Peter, because it highlighted to me the fact that there really is hope, that we really have it in our own hands to change things. As I look at the clock, we are getting right near the top of the hour. Let me leave a final thought with you. Peter?
Oh, you want me to?
Oh, a final thought.
Say something. Collapsing oceans, that's one of our stories. The lies about Fukushima, you know, people are actually dying here in this country from radiation fallout from Fukushima, young babies, and estimated now 14,000 deaths in the U.S. linked to radioactive fallout from Japan. I mean, these are stories that just simply aren't out there. So please, keep informed, find independent sources of news. And if you're not sure where to look, projectcensored.org will take you all over the world.
Oh, that sounds marvelous. Peter, I'll send you an email so you can send me a login code. I just very quickly checked. In May 2008, I wrote about Piven's books. This one is called Challenging Authority.
Okay.
Oh, it's a marvelous book. It's a marvelous book. It lifted me. It gave me hope. It made me understand, just from her book alone, that we really have the power in our hands to change things if we'll only use it collectively. And it doesn't take a majority. It just takes enough committed people to decide they're not going to take this anymore, and they're going to do something about it, and they won't quit until they do. And it happens over and over again. It didn't take millions to end slavery. It won't take millions to end these damn wars and the rest of it. Peter, it was marvelous having you on. I look forward to having you back.
Steve, thanks very much, and I'm glad that you're going to be writing for us.
Oh, well, I am thrilled to death, absolutely thrilled. I'll just remind my listeners, Peter, because I've got another interview coming right up. Tune in on Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.